session number 30366, reel 2.
Work schedules were prepared, and in Japan, to not work meant you would not eat, despite how unwell you might be. A barbarous ill treatment. My first job was in the manufacture of soy sauce at a firm called Ajinomoto, which translates as essence of taste. We had to walk 1 to 2 miles to work, and our task was to set up the presses with clean press cloths and all the necessary steam cleaning of the used ones. This was a huge factory which was also being reconstructed to become able to extract from bauxite clay material to become aluminium for the war effort. I continued to work at Ajinomoto until, I believe, towards Christmas 1942. We were then allowed to send home our first card to let our families know we were still alive. My mother told me on repatriation that my card did not arrive until June 1943. After such a long period of 14 months, I had been considered dead, and in consequence, death benefit had been paid. Patterns of work often changed, and prisoners were often sent to different places of employment, and 60 years on, it is not easy to recollect the exact sequence of changes, so apologies for any errors of timing. Post-Christmas 1942, I was moved to Kawasaki Rail Station to unload freight trucks onto lorries or discharge it directly onto the platform. This became very exacting as a consequence of the meagre diet and the sickness which had seen our bodies become very frail. With a variety of cargoes, some light, some very heavy, the mixture helped us to cope. To do otherwise would have incurred severe punishment. To supplement our diet, one had to steal, and the railway was an ideal place. We soon noted delivery cards on trucks meant perishable goods, usually edible if they had two red lines. The railway yard covered a large area, and it was quite possible to hide from the guards, break the lead seal, and help ourselves to whatever we could. Eggs were cracked and swallowed whole, and raw, small oranges were wolfed down with skins on, and I even ate the heart out of a raw cabbage. To secrete something on your person was too risky, hence the reason for eating at once. To resort to stealing to keep alive was understandable if I describe a typical Japanese diet for prisoners of war. Breakfast consisted of a small bowl of rice and some hot liquid called soup, containing very little solid food and some added miso, a curd material to cloud the absence of vegetables. This menu was repeated at midday on site, and our return to camp in the evening, with no variation for the whole of our stay in Japan. Later, the rice became short and was substituted by Korean rice, which was reddish in colour, and coarse rolled barley. The midday meal carried from camp to work site in wooden rice buckets often turned sour, especially in the summer months, but this had to be eaten or we would have starved. Some meals often arrived with rat droppings cooked in it. Prisoners would extract the feces and as little as possible of the discoloured area. Such a revolting situation was necessary by such hungry men performing such manual tasks. To be expected to live without bread, butter, meat, cheese, fish, and all other forms of European diet was a total contravention of the Geneva Convention for Prisoners of War. But our captors were a sadistic bunch of animals. The lack of such necessities was causing all forms of malnutrition, and I soon developed a large, extremely painful abscess in the groin. Unable to walk or work, I was taken by open lorry to Shinagawa Hospital, a very primitive establishment for assessment. There I met Commander Cleave, Royal Naval Surgeon, a man doing sterling work to help prisoners of war to survive. He decided to launch and drain the abscess, but anaesthetic was at a premium, and I had to be satisfied with a small amount of facial chloroform. I could actually feel the incision before passing out. The diet in Shinagawa was the same as before, but sometimes meat bones were added to the soup. These bones used to be gnawed on by us in the hope of gaining some nutrition. Cards were cut for the privilege. The deaths of several prisoners occurred frequently during my stay. Able to walk again, but extremely weak, I was returned to Karasaki without a hint of convalescence. The weather in Japan in the early months of 1943 was quite similar to the UK, with colder weather in the north, as was shown by freight arriving snow and icebound at Kawasaki. The quality of the issued clothing was totally inadequate for the climate. Paper-thin tie-up trousers with shirts and jackets of the same material. Boots were made of pigskin as issued to the Japanese military and quite good. No underwear was issued, and necessity became the mother of invention. One of my roommates, a huge Australian, had pattern and cutting skills, and coupled with my sewing skills, we manufactured underpants from sawyer-pressed cloths of linen that I had acquired earlier from Ajinomoto. All the Japanese civilians wore army-style putties as some form of respect for their military, so we were forced to conform. Failing to wear them invited another beating. We found the putties quite helpful at times. If we had any contraband, it was convenient to drop it down our trouser legs where it would be retained and mostly missed by a body search. These first 6 months in captivity, working in an outside environment, probably kept us saner than if we had been locked up. We worked in groups with one or two Japanese coolie labour instructed us on our duties. We found working with these low-class Japanese quite a friendly liaison, though. While they were quite sympathetic to our ill treatment and hungriness, to visibly help us would have incurred extreme penalties. The military ruled the roost in Japan, and to carry out any misdemeanors by civilians would have meant a severe physical beating. We were by now picking up quite a smattering of the Japanese language, and this became very useful for scrounging items, mostly cigarettes for those who smoked. Food was also very short for the Japanese, so there was no hope of begging any from them. We found Japanese green tea very unpalatable and considered it to resemble horse's urine. The coolies managed to secretly supply us with some black tea, which we drank with no sugar or milk. The Japanese, in the main very small people, looked quite strange to us, dressed in a short kimono-type jacket, tie-up dungaree trousers and canvas top rubber sole footwear, cloven with a separation for the large toes only. In wet weather, we had to wear rice straw skirts with two wing-type shoulder pads, which afforded no protection from the elements. We looked even stranger than the Japanese. We worked at least 8 hours a day, 7 days a week, but at some point during 1943, we were granted 1 day's rest per month. This rest usually entailed unloading any camp deliveries or ladling the toilet waste into buckets to be taken away by a civilian to spread on his land for vegetable growing. A revolting task. This repetitive lifestyle continued for most of the year, with the occasional loss of life, with most of us getting hungrier and in poorer physical shape. When someone died, the Japanese performed some form of Buddhist ceremony where a mournful dirge was chanted, broken only by the striking of a triangle and the burning of incense. The orange box-type coffin was usually adorned with fruit, rice and vegetables, a ritual not understood by us, by one which would have been better used to feed our bellies. The corpse was then taken away by a cyclist on a three-wheel deer cart to an unknown ending. Christmas came and went, and it was incomprehensible to us how we were still surviving. Spirit and determination not to give in was all that was keeping us going. Early in the year of 1944, I was returned to work at Ajinomoto, but a different job in the newly reconstructed workplace. The new style factory was being formed to be more productive to the war effort. I had to suffer an horrific job on the west side, working on presses where grey-coloured sludge was pumped through to form some manufacturing process towards eventually becoming aluminium. I was forced to stand for hours on end in the residue, which was discharged onto the floor. The smell of chlorine was at times overpowering, and I dreaded each day. By this time, I was becoming very unwell, but by some miracle, a shortage of one man saw me become a member of a construction gang. This company, which subcontracted work to the main company, was called Nihon Kogan Kaisha, or Japanese Steel Company. The main factory was now known as Dainippon Kagakugyo Kibishiki Kaisha, Kawasaki Kojo, Tokyo, Nihon. We were a gang of four prisoners known as Teko, along with a very friendly Japanese crane driver and his assistant, Yoshida-san and Sato-san. The latter bore a striking resemblance to Stan Laurel, and we soon nicknamed him Stan. I began to enjoy work more in the friendly open air, and consequently my health and outlook became brighter. The type of work we were now on gave us a greater movement of freedom from the one or two guards, although they were now assisted by a Japanese civilian known as a Fu Man, who carried the same authority. The massive acreage of the plant made it impossible for these three persons to supervise all the separate gangs working in different areas. The ingenuity of very hungry men now manifested itself fully. Much of the plant had become derelict, but it was always possible to find live electricity, a well-known source for cooking. A convenient flour warehouse used for various products by Ajinomoto, and a store of salt became a regular source of illegal provisions for us. Most prisoners always carried a linen sack for stealing purposes. Kerosene cans had tops cut off to form boiling cans and heating elements of a crude nature by people with a knowledge of electrics were made. Body searches were less prevalent now, so more risks were taken. Flour was taken back to camp one day. Dough of just flour, salt and water made up and carried out again next day to be cooked. This very heavy duff became quite a supplement to our meagre rations. There were so many gangs cooking now that various individuals could be seen darting in and out of derelict places all day long. I should think that the extra load must have shown on the Japanese national grid. Sometimes late cooking meant that the duff had to be removed from heat rather late and was consequently rather hot to carry home to camp. Many prisoners had sore bellies, as the only place to secrete the food was within the tie-up trousers. The camaraderie of the POWs was brilliant, and everyone who contributed to the manufacture had a cut of the spoils. I became very careless and complacent and soon paid the penalty of a severe physical beating when I was caught stealing. I had made a regular habit of taking back a small bottle of soy sauce for my Australian friend Bill Viney. On this particular day, I had hidden 2 kilos of flour in a linen sack in my midriff, held in place by the tie-ups of my trousers, with a loose-fitting jacket camouflaging the rest. I kept Bill's bottle of sauce in a back pocket, carelessly not dropping it down my trouser leg. Unfortunately, a body search was called for on site, and the bottle was discovered. 3 others were found with contraband, and we were all sent to front of ranks, where we received a father and a mother of beating by the guard. Each time the butt of the rifle hit different parts of my anatomy, the sack of flour moved, making me look quite pregnant. Colleagues in the front row kept advising me by signs to make adjustments while he was punishing the others. God's mercy, he never spotted the other sack. Searches on site usually meant a report to the camp sergeant, but luckily we were dismissed on the count back being correct. Such relief, and Bill's remark of "Did you bring the sawyer back?" was a trifle ironic. The Japanese climate was very similar to the UK, with very comfortable warm weather right up till Christmas. This made working conditions more favourable. Despite almost every POW showing rib cage bones and projecting hip bones, our frames seemed to be hardening to the treatment, and I'm sure our stomachs must have shrunk as the meagre rations easily seemed to satisfy us. We were constantly being used as guinea pigs for some serum or other, and regular checks were made for cholera, as the Japanese had a desperate fear of this disease. The weeks and months continued to pass, and there seemed little hope the war was nearing an end, and the Japanese prognosis for us, should they lose the war, was decapitation, not a very optimistic outlook. With some of the POWs being Chinese and a great similarity of the printed characters with Japanese writing, we gleaned some information of US successes from the odd newspapers. Without remembering the time scale of these events, we knew the islands of Saipan and Okinawa had been recovered from the Japanese. It could have been between late 1944 and the early months of 1945. This began to put a brighter spring into our step. The next ordeal we had to suffer was constant night bombing by waves of US B-29 aircraft with incendiary devices. Thankfully so, because if the bombs had been of high explosive, we would not have survived due to their accuracy. Kawasaki was literally razed to the ground, with virtually all the lower class dwellings destroyed. These places were so primitive and made mainly of wood, paper and corrugated iron. One must remember that 1945 was not like the modern day Japan. With almost 200 prisoners, we were able to defeat the fire hazard by beating out the flying charcoal embers falling on the roof. And without a direct hit, Kawasaki No. 1 camp survived, standing out like an oasis in the desert. For nights afterwards, the Japanese civilians huddled around the outside perimeter of the camp, thinking perhaps that the Americans knew our whereabouts. With little left to flatten, the raid ceased and work was continued most days. We now had expectations of things going our way and dared to hope perhaps of a release from our horror. On August the 6th, after the usual day's work on site, we were met by our coolie supervisors, all wearing horror-struck and solemn expressions on their faces. The atom bomb had been dropped on Hiroshima, which was on the same island of Honshu as Kawasaki, albeit some 300 miles away. The description by our supervisors of the magnitude of devastation and loss of life was a severe shock to all Japanese we came into contact with. This was a great boost to our morale, and we began to look forward to each day and the new developments it brought with it. At last we knew things were definitely going in favour of the Allies. We went to work every day between the 6th and 15th of August, the actual date of the Japanese surrender. On one day during this time, we ceased work at midday for lunch, but the restart afterwards was delayed for 1 to 2 hours, making us wonder if hostilities had ceased. We wandered about outside the mess room trying to get some confirmation of the happenings for the delay. This finally came from a passing Japanese who raised his hands in the air in the surrender position and said Nippon. With still no official confirmation, we were reformed in ranks and marched back to camp. We were ordered to stay. Still being under armed guard, discretion was the better part of valour. To do anything foolish would have been ridiculous after surviving 3.5 years of such horror. History has since proved that this particular day I've described must have been August the 15th, 1945. The American officer in charge of our camp, Commander Newman, kept us aware of instructions and how we were to conform. We were to join blankets together to make a large drape and mark with a large cross to hang over the camp roof to be visible from the air. The bombing started again, but this time the dropping of parachute supplies was favourable to us very hungry men. The generosity of the Americans knew no bounds. They were such generous people. We were now able to indulge ourselves, perhaps a little too much for comfort at times. As starving men, we were inclined to ignore the advice not to overeat or over-medicate. Collecting some of the parachute supplies meant leaving the confines of the camp to retrieve them, and we considered this now being our privilege. One of the Japanese guards took exception to this despite still being unarmed, he chose to confront a Scottish POW, Mince McKay, who immediately flattened him, breaking his own wrist in the process, but gaining immense satisfaction. Months earlier, aggression like this would have meant a life-threatening beating, with an added bonus of being tied to a post naked all night. The Japanese officer, Lieutenant Takahuchi, has since left in a hurry, and for the few guards that remained, it was now time to be prudent. This magnificent new lifestyle continued for some days, until on an unknown date we were instructed to assemble and make our way by foot to the harbour of Tokyo Bay. It has to be remembered at this time there were no American land forces ashore, hence the foot slogging. The walk took some time through dilapidated bombed areas, but proceeded with little incident. The Japanese were showing a cowardly absence despite their bravades of what would happen to us should they lose the war. None of us were decapitated, nor did I see any Japanese who committed harakiri, the method of disemboweling on the sword for the shame of defeat in battle. On arrival at the harbour, we were taken by DUKW landing barges to the US hospital ship Benevolence, anchored in Tokyo Bay. We were thoroughly medically examined and treated where necessary, and once again showered by the supreme hospitality of our American allies. No POW was expected to lift a finger, just to rest, eat, and recuperate. After several days of this luxury, and again on an unknown date, we left Tokyo Bay and headed for Manila, capital of the Philippine island of Luzon. This time we were housed in tents, which the Americans call bivouac. Again expected to do nothing but convalesce, despite all this wonderful treatment and gaining in strength, weight and fitness, the pangs of returning home were closest to our minds. We were given the choice of a quicker flight home or a longer sea voyage. I chose the latter, influenced by the fact that I had lost my brother Ted in the RAF 6 weeks before the end of hostilities. I promised earlier in these memoirs to elaborate more on Ted's misadventure. This is now fully described in another file. I was allocated a place on the SS Empress of Australia for the voyage to the UK via Colombo in Ceylon, Suez Canal, Alexandria, Gibraltar and Liverpool, arriving late October 1945. On arrival at Liverpool, the mayor greeted us with a welcoming speech. Then, after being re-kitted with our service clothing, we were given an early, very brief medical examination to establish our suitability to return to our homes without delay. Promise of a more thorough medical within 1 month was made, and after being granted 12 weeks foreign service leave, the necessary warrants and travel arrangements were made. Officially, we were still members of HM Forces, with a decision to be made later on early release. The expectations of returning home were exhilarating, exciting and very emotional, and the journey home to Norwich seemed never ending.